Hello everyone, I'm Tom.
And I'm Charlie.
And this is Tom Aspinall's The Inner Game podcast and a very special guest on today.
Who have we got this week, mate? You're a big fan.
This is the most special guest for me. This is Mr. Louis Theroux, predominantly a documentary maker. Mate, I have seen, I said to him when he was here, obviously this is... We recorded this quite a while ago, but I've met him a couple of times before. I've said to him a couple of times before that I think every bit of content that he's ever done, I have seen it. So just talking about that, I feel like I've done it all with him, even though I've not. I've just seen it. Getting to know his mindset on it, getting to know him as a person. Like I say, we have met a couple of times before, but I never had the chance to sit down with him like we are doing this podcast. And yeah. We had a good chat.
I felt honoured to be in the room, mate, with such a romance going on, a bromance. But it was also very timely because it was filmed around when the Manus had gone out. So Louis came up to Manchester for us. What a genuine, lovely person as well. And also, you will be treated to one of Louis's awkward pauses. How did you find that?
Yeah, it was good. It was good to be involved in that. He did throw me off when he started like interviewing me. I was like, well, bro, this is my podcast, actually. But yeah, we had a great time, like you say, right after the Manosphere thing. I think it was actually the day before.
Day after.
The day after it came out. But anyway, let's let the people get into it. Let's go over to the episode.
Hello and welcome to Tom Aspinall's The Inner Game. We are at Champion Combat Centre and this podcast is all about speaking to elite performers across different professions, hearing their story, hearing about their mindset, mentality, and of course, how to get to the top. And who better to do it with than none other than UFC heavyweight champion, Tom Aspinall. Tom, you always get asked this question when I'm there about dream dinner guests, and obviously you've got the usual answers, you know, HS Tiki Toki and people like that.
You've set me up.
who we got?
Set me up. No, we've got Louis Theroux in today, which I'm very happy with. Louis, I'm not sure there's a documentary that you've put out that I've not watched.
Wow. So I don't think even I've watched all of them. So that's,
I've got,
it might be government health recommendations against doing that, but thank you for the support.
I've enjoyed it very much, and I've got a ridiculous amount of questions for you today.
Nice.
But I'm going to try and tame it. I'm not going to, you know, there's not going to be too much super fandom come out, hopefully. But
he does always say Ramsey Pilkington and Theroux. That's his.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ramsey Pilkington Theroux sounds like a Victorian explorer.
I've been trying to get, I think, Kyle Pilkington is my number one person to get on the podcast.
You could get him on. He's very choosy though, isn't he? Well, I don't think he's choosy, but you don't see him doing a lot of stuff.
Apparently, I've heard like in the circles that he moves in that he just won't do anything publicly anymore.
Really?
Which is a shame because we would absolutely.
What a great way to build your legend, you know, your myth.
Yeah.
What's it like being up in Manchester? You enjoying it?
Nice. Yeah. My son goes to Manchester Uni. So it's a chance to see him, enjoy some northern hospitality, have a break from the family. I'm a family man, but a night away is very replenishing. And then I'll be back in the grind tonight.
You always say that as well.
Sometimes when I'm away, I absolutely am a family man as well. But sometimes when I go away for work, I feel like it's my little holiday.
The little holiday.
Yeah, I do feel like that.
Secret, isn't it?
It is. I'm like, go away. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I've been working, but I do kind of like it as well.
It's that thing of, I remember, especially when the kids are small, mine are pretty grown now. I've got an 11, an 18, and a 20. But when you're in that war zone of them being really small, and I remember being on the plane on the way out, and people would be like, oh, it must be intense going into those prisons. I'm like, actually, it's surprisingly relaxing compared with what goes on at home. I used to say a prison was my happy place. I know that's kind of a dark joke, but truthfully, I've made several docs that took place in prisons. I was in San Quentin for 2 or 3 weeks. I was at Miami Mega Jail for 3 or 4 weeks over the course of several trips. I did one about a mental hospital for violent sexual predators. And I don't want this to sound glib or trivializing, but it's shoot-wise, filming-wise, It's a sort of very straightforward proposition. They can't go anywhere. You're not having to track them down. You know, that normal thing of like, oh, the gang boss isn't returning our calls, or we can't seem to track down, you know, the heroin addict that we were following. They're all in their cells. You work 9 to 5 because the guards who are usually chaperoning you don't want to go late. And then you go home and you're at your hotel. I'm starting to sound like very cushy, but it is kind of cushy.
I've seen everything that you've just spoke about, obviously. It amazed me. Is like, especially, I think it was the San Quentin one. You interviewed a guy with like, he had like slick back hair and he'd done like multiple home invasions, torture tactics.
David Silver, home invasion. He would torture people in order for them, possibly, I don't know if it was for his pleasure. He said in order to get them to say where their valuables were, but he had a little, he almost said it with a degree of pride.
He seemed like he enjoyed the process of torturing people and getting what he needs, but it always seemed to me like surprisingly how normal they were. Like they seemed to be like not as crazy as you would imagine, thinking about for the stuff they'd done.
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, that's why early on when I started out all those years ago, Weird Weekends, I remember being struck. One of the first things I did was about a guy who was a neo-Nazi, and he was at a compound that belonged to a sort of terrorist-affiliated group called Aryan Nations. They're the most sort of violent, most feared white supremacist organization. And I remember arriving, and the two guys who showed up, one was Pastor Richard Butler. He was the head, and then his friend and sort of lieutenant, Jerry Grudel. And Jerry Grudel was like, "It's so nice to have you here. I'm a big fan of England. I spent some time in Cheltenham and I love Benny Hill." And, you know, of all the things, all the scenarios you've played out in your head beforehand, are they going to mug me? Are they going to jump me? Are they going to think that I'm Jewish? Is it going to go sideways? Will they set their dogs on me? The fact that they might say, "I'm a big fan of Benny Hill and I love Cheltenham," is obviously yeah, not high on the list. But afterwards, I remember thinking, wow, not only does he have this surprising fondness for British culture and a kind of visiting BBC journalist, but that he was trying to like, he was trying to befriend me in some way. Like maybe he was lonely or whatever it was. He was like, "Oh, I want to be friendly to this guy." And afterwards I was like, I remember thinking like, wow, the weirdest thing about weird people is how normal they are.
Yeah.
To your point.
Yeah.
But there's an analog to that, which brings us to the sort of the mental health side of life in general, but also success. You mentioned at the beginning that you're interested in success, is that the most normal thing about normal people is how weird they are. Like that we're all presenting as functional, pro-social, on top of life, in control, but underneath, we're also struggling in significant ways.
How do you see yourself in all of that, what you've just spoken about?
I always see my work as a way of trying to connect. And obviously, it's a way of making a living as well. And it's a way of entertaining people and maybe providing insight into the world. But I'm someone who early on, like a lot of people, you know, worried I didn't fit in. It's always hard to know, like, what are other people going through? And you think, oh, they've got it figured out. Truthfully, you sort of think, like, I think everyone at times feels like a bit of an outsider. And I used to find that growing up, I was also very worry prone. So I would catastrophize. I'd look at something, I'm never going to be able to do that. I'm still a little bit like that. Like, oh, like the other night, like I've got my premiere of this new documentary. It's called Louis Theroux Inside the Manosphere. And we had a special screening that BAFTA put on and Netflix helped to organize, and everyone was there that was associated with the production, some journalists. And it got to the moment where we were going to watch it. I've seen it obviously lots of times in the process of the edit, but I was like, I don't think I want to go and sit in the auditorium with everyone. I think that'll be really uncomfortable. Truthfully, I knew it would make me anxious, and I'd be, I felt anxious thinking about it. And I thought, I'll just sit in the green room and everyone else will be out there. And the Netflix executive looked at me as if to be like, she's actually a friend. So she kind of looked at me as if like, okay, but it was all like, really? Like, that's quite weird. And And I said, like, you know what? Snap out of it. Get in there. Stop being ridiculous. So I went in and I was really glad I did. But it's just to illustrate the point that I tend to, and it was, in fact, not only was it good that I did it, like, not only was it fine, it was really helpful to see how the film connected with the audience, what it felt like seeing with some distance, seeing tiny little changes that had been made late in the process. And the takeaway for me was that I'd built up the experience, an experience that promised to be ever so slightly awkward, I decided to opt out of. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'd build it up into something too big. And so in life, certainly early on, I would have shied away from anything that felt not difficult. Like, I worked hard. I was very studious. I was a high achiever in school. I would force myself to do things if it felt like that was socially required. But I would opt out of things that seemed intimidating or that I could. So the idea that I was in TV, for example, I would never have got into TV if other people hadn't said, you should do this and we're going to give you this opportunity, because the idea would have been too intimidating.
Was that Adam Buxton, your friend, and having that kind of environment? Because we've already sort of seen by speaking to people that are successful that their environment's a big part, but then also the self-belief at that kind of age to go forward with. You've said the same thing, haven't you, as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think sometimes you do need a bit of peer pressure to be like, right, you're pretty good at this. Yeah. So did you always have in mind, like, I want to be a documentary maker, I want to interview people, I want to do that? And you had your, because for me, your style of an interviewer or a documentary maker is quite niche.
Yeah.
In the fact that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're a very intelligent man.
Thank you.
Socially, you can have that one. You socially very intelligent as well.
I think we're all very intelligent, aren't we?
Well, I'd get punched in the face for a living, so.
Yeah, I don't really know what I mean, but I'm just his friend.
But it seems to me that you almost create moments of awkwardness purposefully. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. So do you do that consciously, or is that just kind of your personality?
Okay, so
there's so much to unwind there from.
So to the first bit, no, I didn't grow up. I didn't grow up thinking, one day I'm going to be on documentaries. In fact, the opposite, like the idea of being on TV, it felt like another world. You know, just like, I don't know how you get from here to there. Even the idea of working at the BBC later on, as an older person, like when I was at university, I sort of thought, I don't know how people get into that. But I started writing articles for newspapers, and people thought they were funny. And I knew I had a little bit of a gift for a certain kind of humor. And I thought, maybe I can work with that. My dad's a writer. My mum worked as a producer at the BBC World Service. And I remember thinking, well, if I can start writing articles on a local paper, that's how I got my start. Then later on, I was watching, like, you know, everyone, I suppose, watching a lot of TV and thinking about programs I enjoyed. And the idea of my dream at that time was to write television, to write for a sitcom like a Seinfeld or The Simpsons, something like that. And I put quite a lot of energy into trying to do that. And then some people said, like, you'd be great on this new show. Like, you're naturally quite funny and you could be a presenter, a host. This show was Michael Moore's TV Nation. I was living in New York at the time. And as I say, it was their belief in me. I would never have gone up for the job under my own auspices. It was the fact that my friend Chris Kelly, an American comedy writer, said, you've got something. And to the Adam Buxton connection you mentioned, Charlie, like, it was more that actually having had close friends at school like Adam and a couple of others who were really funny, I thought, well, I'm less funny than they are. That almost held me back a little bit. I almost thought, like, oh, I don't know. Like, why am I being asked to be on TV ahead of someone? I mean, Adam was in the UK at the time, but I was only 23, so it just felt like a strange level of trust in my abilities. To the question about awkward silences, I have always enjoyed the comedy of awkwardness.
Same.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in fact, like when something on TV growing up, that feeling when, when you're 6, 7, 8 and you see TV going wrong, you know, like there's a malfunction of some kind or a dog peas on the set, you know, whatever it might be. When you're a kid, you're like, oh my God, that's so exciting. I didn't know that was allowed. Anytime when it felt like something was slightly jumping the tracks, or just the comedy of embarrassment, is just so, I didn't say, oh, and that's what I'm going to do. That's just my, that's sort of my natural sensibility.
Was Weird Weekends though, was that the sort of moment where you thought I could do this as a, it was a kind of career changing moment?
The career changing moment was earlier than that. Well, you know, it's like in life, I'm sure it's the same with you, Tom. Like, it's not like there's not one moment where I'm here now, I've arrived at the sunlit uplands of success. And there's no going back. It's like climbing a mountain, you know, there's little moments where you're like, wow, I've achieved this. I really didn't expect it. But there were a couple of significant ones. And one was when I got hired on TV Nation and then was sent out on location and was filming my first segment in 1994. And in the course of filming it, I grew in confidence. And by the end, I was like, wow, I think we've got something. Like, I think maybe I've done an okay job on this, my first TV excursion. Weird Weekends was another, the first episode of Weird Weekends, when I was filming, I thought, this is going quite well. And then you just build your confidence little by little.
For me, it's like the goalposts always keep moving. Like, I had an idea in my mind when I was younger, what I thought would be, I would be kind of satisfied with.
Yeah.
Of like, right, if I do this, then I'll be feeling good about myself.
Exactly.
And then that happens and I'm like, well, actually,
you have a moment, that's great, and then yeah, you've got a new one.
And it's constantly like that with me. It's always...
You've always had a clear passion. Is your clear passion always been for people?
Creativity, I think. Like, the idea of producing something, you know, making something. It doesn't have to be a documentary. It turns out that seems to be, if it had been something else, like if I could have been, like I say, a sitcom writer or a director, even an artist. I did art A-level, and one of my few regrets in life is that I didn't then go on to pursue art a bit more and go to do a foundation course or something. But anything where at the end of a few hours or a few days, you've made something and other people are like, yeah, that's really good, I really like that. Or that was shit.
I mean, I bet you get the... So is that kind of the reason why you were saying about the premiere of Manosphere?
Yeah.
And you didn't want to sit in the room where everyone else is watching it. Is it because of that instant feedback that makes you uncomfortable?
Maybe. Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah.
It's sitting in the room, feeling what they're feeling, feeling that I've got a bad habit of seeing everything that's wrong with something, thinking like, yeah, that's good, but... I would have done that slightly. I don't know. I've got a relentless, maybe it's in some ways a gift, but this sort of relentless sense of self-criticism that in some ways means that you keep going, try and make it better. And sometimes that's positive. Like, you can take a painstaking approach to improving something. And then sometimes it can be destabilizing, even disabling. Right. That's why I sometimes think when I write, like, as I said, my dad's a writer. Growing up, I thought, well, I'm supposed to be a writer, like novels, travel books. And I still write from time to time, and I've written a few books, but the process is so punishing because I'm second guessing and questioning everything I write. And sometimes I just want to get out of my head and enjoy a more free flowing kind of creativity.
Yeah. I think predominantly, this kind of stuff I speak to other professional fighters about. Mm. So my like genre, if you like, is obviously professional fighting. And I know that a lot of successful professional fighters feel the same way that I do. But now with launching this podcast and talking to different professional peoples in different fields, I think everyone seems to be the same.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to have the thing of, oh, I've not quite done enough there.
Yeah.
I constantly feel
self-critical,
like
anxiety.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated because I know I really want to get into this with both of you, is that especially in today's world and obviously what you've just worked on, do you read the comments on social media to everything that you just said there? And how does it make you feel?
I used to read them quite a lot, and I have a lot to be grateful to social media for. When I was like about 10, 15 years into my career, when both Netflix was getting going and Twitter was in its early days, as it was called then, I got this sort of second lease of life career-wise. Like, everything was going fine. I was still working, but it was just nice to see. I would go on Twitter and look at comments, and it would be things like, Well, my money don't jiggle, jiggle, it folds, right? And this was before that track went viral, but it was the second generation that was discovering my episode of Weird Weekends that was about the rap world in which I did that rap, made in 99 or 2000. So this was like 15 years after that. And other people were like, oh, I love, you know, Louis Theroux, blah, blah, blah. I love his programs. And it gave me an enormous rush to think of. It was almost like a little dopamine. I guaranteed I was being discovered. So it was never negative. I felt like I was this little discovery that the next generation down were making. Then later on, social media changed a bit, became, I think, a lot of Twitter, X as it now is, became more negative. The comments, it was more like, anyway, like negative comments. Not all, you know, mostly positive, but you see negative. And yeah, I'm like everyone, I'm not a huge fan of looking at that. I tend not to look at that many comments now.
It's the balance, though, for everything that you're saying. And yeah, and you, this is something that you really struggle with, isn't it, with comments?
Yeah, but I think I'm getting to the point now where I'm so far in that it doesn't affect me as much as it used to.
Which is your platform that you're looking at?
Instagram.
I mean, I'm across all platforms, but I only really use Instagram, if truth be told.
Which tends to be a little more positive than X, right?
But post-injury and obviously all the sort of scandal around that, Tom was at a place again.
The eye injury.
Yeah, the eye injury. So that's where it's obviously been quite a bit of a shift as well. And
what was coming in?
It's difficult because from like sitting here now, like 6 months on or whatever it is, I can see that I'm in a position where I'm like having a UFC world title fight, which is obviously that's the peak of the mountain in the MMA world. And people who are commenting on it generally have never had a fight in their life. So it's like, I get it. I shouldn't really listen to that kind of stuff. But at the time I was feeling like hypersensitive about it all. And it was generally like, you should have carried on.
Carried on in the fight.
Your
eyes poked.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not the majority opinion, right?
I think the negative speaks louder than the positive mind.
That would agree. And it's crazy how you could have 99 positive and one negative. And not only is the negative the one that sticks, but it's also sometimes you find like the one that you feel an urge to respond to.
Yeah, 100%.
And you're like, why would I reward negativity with attention?
There's a lot of that going on with me. And I'm like, it's the negative one that sticks. Like you say, that the other ones just sail past, and then that one's just like, oh, you bastard, that did touch a nerve a little bit. Maybe I should have carried on. I don't know. There's a lot of that been going on. But at the same time, it's like, well, if I can't see because of an illegal move, then why should I?
You know, well, 100%, yeah.
And I think it seems rational now sitting in a room talking about it, but at the time, I don't know. I think there's a lot of, and we'll come on to this soon because I'm desperate to ask you, but in the like MMA world, there is a lot of like toxic masculinity traits in that as well. I think it goes hand in hand where it's like we are supposed to be like quote unquote warriors and continue through everything. But at the same time, it is a sport as well. And you do have your own life, your own kids and all the rest of it, the future going on. So I can kind of see both sides, but I think I definitely made the right decision because if I would have carried on and fought somebody blind, I don't think it would.
Someone could have kicked you in the head.
I can hear there's a lot of turmoil in you even now.
There is still, because it's still a bit painful for me, to be honest.
Well, let's talk about the MMA world because, as you know, like my documentary is about the Manosphere and a very inexact, my latest, I should say, the one that's up on Netflix. And the term is very inexact, in some ways, I'm not looking at the Manosphere. I'm looking at this extreme end of people who exist within that world, who are particularly misogynistic, homophobic, racist, and they're in a little cluster. But nevertheless, there's overlap, and they kind of crave an association with a more respectable end of masculine pursuits. I tried quite hard because I've been on Joe Rogan a couple of times. I've been on Theo Von. Like, there's, I'm a fan of comedy that, you know, that pushes the edge a bit. Like the sense of performing, like I was saying about the worlds that I'm curious about, they're somewhat extreme. And then part of that is sort of immersing yourself in taking yourself out of your comfort zone a little bit. Nevertheless, these guys love Trump. They love Dana White. Dana has a very quick cameo in the doc.
I did notice.
Yeah, I saw that.
Did notice.
Yeah. I watched that. I wonder if my MMA privilege, my UFC privilege.
Oh, it may be.
I think you said that a couple of the guys I featured, you had maybe had encounters with?
I've met, it's funny because I'm obviously from the UK, but the UK guys I didn't really know. I'm familiar with HS Tiki Toki, but only because I've seen him on socials.
Harrison Sullivan.
That's it.
He's kind of the main character.
He is. He really is. Yeah. But the other guys, Sneeko, I've actually met. And the other fella's name,
Balenthazi, who Sneeko's maybe the most, he's got the biggest profile of the people we follow and has huge currency for teenage boys, certainly in America and in the UK. Where would you have met him? Because he's not MMA related, is he?
He's been at events.
Yeah, he's been at events.
Justin has as well, hasn't he?
Justin Waller.
Yeah. Justin, him
Sneeko
being the...
he did get in the ring with someone as well.
Yeah, with Sean Strickland. He's a UFC fighter also. Yeah.
And Sean Strickland kind of duffed him up.
He definitely duffed him up.
He didn't oh, here we go. I have a chuckle a few punches. Oh, you're a really good kid. He actually seemed to... Did he go full bore or... he didn't... He certainly...
Oh, he was definitely giving him some. Yeah, he definitely was. But he seemed on the documentary, at least, that he wasn't. It's fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the documentary is predominantly about toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. Is that right to say? Is that fair?
I would say it's about the ways in which pushing extreme masculine or masculinist content has captivated boys. Which the influencers themselves. Whether they really believe all of that is sort of up for grabs. They say women shouldn't vote, women shouldn't be allowed to drive, women are weak, along those lines. And then behind that is a sales grift, if you like, an attempt to upsell the kids on different products.
Sneeko to me seemed to be the one kind of different in a way where he wasn't. Or at least on the documentary, it came across that he was less about women and more about anti-Jews and that kind of thing, as opposed to the other guys seem to be a bit more misogynistic.
There's a drift in the culture. And Sneeko, he's always been slightly, from what I've seen, in a sense, a bellwether, one step ahead of where things are going. I also think it's possible he's less... cynically attempting to upsell his followers on products. He's one of the few that doesn't have, he may have had at one time, but he doesn't now have an online university. You know, that term that you pay $50 a month and you can join my online university. Sneeko seems to be a bit more picky about not trying, or my crypto portal. I think he probably has a few, but he's kind of arrived at this post red pill being another term they use. Ideology of the world is run by a shadowy cabal. That's his thing, and which is has, as I said in the doc, kind of the hallmarks of an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory.
I've met him, Sneeko, and the other gentleman.
What was the vibe? Did you make anything of him? He's quite charming.
Didn't know. It was just a quick hello. It wasn't. I didn't really know much.
In the US?
It was in the US, yeah. And the other fella,
Justin Waller.
He's the ginger gentleman.
Yeah.
No, not him.
Looks a bit like Kevin De Bruyne.
Yeah. No,
that's a great show.
He does.
Or Prince Harry, whichever.
One of the two. No, it wasn't the fella from Miami who's not him.
Myron Gain.
I've met him as well. But I met him at, I think it was at Power Slap. Are you familiar with Power Slap?
I am.
We've been to a couple of times.
How did you feel when you met Myron? Because he was the one out of everyone that I watched last night that I felt the most uncomfortable.
He's the most extreme.
Yeah. Did you feel that when it came across?
It's odd because actually in person, as you see, he's cordial. In person, like he's not sneering or hostile. Like he, in terms of how I kind of conversed with him, but his actual views are as extreme as anyone out there. And his big thing, yeah, even of the things like we, you know, for reasons of time and whatnot, we couldn't get into all of it, but, you know, he's like, gay people should be rounded up and put in special camps where they don't mix with other people. And as I say, like women shouldn't vote. And then he has these women on his show, and I was a guest on his show. I don't know. It's like, it's a very odd thing.
How do you keep such a line in that situation when he's saying such comments?
It's a fine line because I'm there to do a job, which is interview, but then also appropriately challenge, but I also can't, I'm not there to do a full kind of Jeremy Kyle, you know, you're disgusting, aren't you? You know, what's wrong with you? Like, not sure, shout and sort of disparage. But the revealing moment was when his girlfriend popped up, Angie, and you suddenly realize that together, she seems really sweet, and they're, as a unit, it feels like actually there's some mutuality there. They're like kind of fond of each other. And she says, in fact, oh, he's really nice. And, you know, he puts on a persona for the camera, but behind the scenes, a very sweet guy. And you can see him like, you're trying to write, is he annoyed by that? And then he, one of the things they advocate is called one-way monogamy. The idea men should have multiple girlfriends, multiple wives, but the women have to absolutely be strictly faithful and ideally should be virgins or have a minuscule body count, like minimal body count. And men have to have that maximal body count. There's one guy in the film who's like, I've slept with 2,000 women. Anyway, so she's there saying like, oh, I ask her about that. And she's like, well, I don't know. And when we get married, I'm not sure about that. It's clear she doesn't like the idea of him going off having other wives. And then that was the moment where I feel like you see his mask slip a bit. That sort of sense that he's kind of performing his extremism in some ways. And then he also that he feels humiliated because then he tried very hard to get us to remove that from the documentary.
Yeah, I wonder if the cameras go off and they just think, oh, thank fuck for that. Yeah. Like, let's just have a minute of being...
That's part of it, though. And I think actually, irrespective of the beliefs, like leaving the beliefs to one side for a second, imagine what it does to you streaming, as a lot of these guys do, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And he's in his apartment, which is also his studio, gets up midday, gets on stream like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, streams till 1 or 2 in the morning. The relentlessness of that feedback loop of content creation and also comments in the chat. You know, we were talking about social media and what your negativity and what that does, but these guys don't have the option of switching that off. They're always pandering to, responding to whatever comes in. In fact, Sneeko's talked about the burnout that goes with that. It must be very weird to existentially to live that and to work that way.
It's got to be absolutely exhausting.
Being a dad in today's society and seeing social media and obviously being filmed in this documentary, where does it sit with you in sort of your feelings and thoughts and away from work as well?
Well, that one of the reasons I did the documentary was because I remember shortly after the pandemic, when Andrew Tate was first going viral and he was the big man of the scene, and my kids seeing his content and hearing it. And so I was hearing about him and then it just felt like that just ran and ran. Like Andrew Tate was in the culture and everywhere you went, it felt like people were talking about him and so... You don't want to overparent. You want kids to find their own identity, and part of pushing back against your parents is understandable. Like we all want to, as children, we sort of, you know, kids. There's a certain outlaw, vagabond energy that kids really respond to. Like, I remember liking punk and then gangster rap. And I remember with gangster rap, if you look at some of the lyrics, they're horrific. But you also think, well, that's not real life. I mean, some of it is in actual fact, but you think, like, this is a sort of area of show business. So part of me tried to read the masculinist content in that spirit of, this is kind of show business. But there's also a time when it becomes something more than that. So I'm trying to kind of, I try very hard to contextualize with my kids. I talk to them about stuff. I try and be present for them and, you know, show what a healthy, hopefully healthy relationship looks like, you know, with my wife, and be a, as I said, present dad. Like, I'm a homebody. I like to cook. I like to play football with them. I like to take them to the football, but I also like to just hang out and, you know, goof around, play games. And I think, you know, it's a sort of 3D approach to being a parent, and but it's really hard. And, like, you know, with phones especially, you can't really see what they're watching then.
It's a lot of parallels, though, because you always talk about, when we come away from fight weeks, about your grounding as your kids and having that sort of time away. And
yeah, I think for me, having kids is like, it's a big reality check a lot of the time. I think that, yeah, like, I'm sure you're off the back of doing this documentary now, and the kids, I don't know, but I'm sure they're not really that bothered about it.
No.
And yeah. I get that a lot. I get that so many times.
But you know what they do like? UFC.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. And especially the middle one, he's the one who turned me onto it. And he's always like, oh, Dad, you should talk to Tom Aspinall. He was the one who said, like, you need to talk to Leon Edwards. I think I jinxed Leon, unfortunately.
Yeah, he's on a bad run.
Maybe it's not a good idea to, you know, maybe.
Yeah, hopefully it's not start
a
bad thing.
I might be your Jonah. Take the ship down. No, that's a joke, of course. But, you know, the feeling of, like, that's actually the thing too as well. My kids' favorite things, probably, like, growing up as teenagers, as I say, the middle one especially, were grime and drill music,
yep.
YouTubers to an extent, football, and boxing and UFC. Like, very masculine pastimes, right? Old school, kind of conventionally understood, a sense in which, like, it models a slightly traditional masculine attitude, like, not a world where, like, certainly football, like, gay footballers are still in short supply. Do you know what I mean? Whether because of some sense of not wanting to come out or whatever it might be, but also, like, areas in which men can, you know, and boys can feel a lot of pride and aspire to something. So to your point, though, yeah, they definitely wouldn't be like, Dad, I really want to be a documentary maker like you, or it's really cool making documentaries. But they'd be like all in on UFC. And you know this because I've seen you at fights, but it was first of all taking my son to fights that kind of gave me the bug to go, you know, for going to see fights and appreciating my brother as well. My brother's been following it for years, and I used to do some training in a boxing gym. But once you've been to a couple of those UFC gigs, but your kids must love. No, I guess they're a bit too young to watch your fights.
My oldest one, he does watch it and stuff. But
is it weird for them?
I think it's quite normal for him.
Tell Louis a few of the stories that your oldest one said to you. Like, for example, when you came back after the GAN fight, what was he dressed up?
When I came back from my last fight, my wife decided to buy everyone eye patches.
Really?
And then, like, I opened the door and everyone had an eye patch on. So they bring you back down to earth pretty quick. Actually, recently, yesterday, so where I'm from is like a small town on the outside of Manchester. And not a lot of people from my town have done, like, a lot of quote-unquote big things. Mm-hmm. And they kind of brought me up in an assembly. And my mum works at the school as well, so I knew this was going on. And brought me up on the big screen. And obviously everyone looks at my kids and be like, oh, it's your dad, whatever. And trying to get any information out of any of my kids of what they were talking about was like getting blood out of a stone.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, what did they say? I don't know. Well, what was it about? Like, they're just shrugging me.
Recognize that.
But what's your?
I don't want to talk about how was school today. Fine. Like, talk about questions designed to make them not say it.
Yeah, they don't. And I'm learning that as I'm progressing.
The other thing is I'm their dad. Like, I don't aspire to be their favorite broadcaster. I aspire to be their favorite dad. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely.
And I'm aware, it's like in my programs, I am being me, but I'm also being a version of me that's designed to elicit the most information while also being hopefully amusing. I'm kind of goofy at times. And that's not the dad that they know. And I imagine it's probably simpler for them in some ways to just engage with like me as dad.
Hi guys, delighted to announce that Prize Guy are the official sponsor for Tom Aspinall's The Inner Game podcast. This week with that Prize Guy, you can win £90,000 cash tax-free for just 40p a ticket. This is honestly a mad prize. You can enter now by clicking the link in the description or clicking the QR code. Visit thatprizeguy.co.uk for more. You do not want to miss this.
I love, though, what you said at the start about how obviously you've got life going on at home and that can be stressful. And it really sort of, I can tell listening to you, it really matters to you there because that's life.
Yeah.
And then you've got your job and you're sat in prisons and the rest of it. Is that almost like your sort of superpower, that inner dialogue thinking, actually, I've got to do this for the kids when I get back.
Yeah.
This is just work. And this is, you know, when you're in such, to us watching, uncomfortable, dangerous situations, does that really help having that kind of core life at home?
Yeah, definitely. I think if I didn't have my core life, I wouldn't, I'm going to sound really cringe, but having, meeting my wife and then having a family gave me a grounding that I needed. And there was a time early on when I was in TV and I was quite successful, but my relationships sort of situation wasn't as well as it could have been. I was either single or I'm not brilliant at being single. That's one of my, I wonder if that's kind of, I don't know if that's a male thing or anyway.
I'm shocking.
Really? Yeah. So it's not like, anyway, without going too deep into that, I mean, I'm a sort of serial monogamist, like coming up, I just need a relationship. Like this is great. This will do me. And then there was a time when, I was quite successful. Like my TV shows were getting really high ratings, but there wasn't much going on at home. And I remember finding it really difficult. So now I have this, you've got to look after your home base, your support network, your whatever it is that's got to be solid. You sort of, I feel like for me anyway, need both. You sort of need, I mean, it's like we were saying about, going and having a holiday by going off and fighting or being in a prison. It's nice to go between the two places. They say the cliches, you're supposed to have three actually.
What would be the other one?
Third place, this is going to sound weird, but it's supposed to be the pub. Have you never heard that? The third place. There's a term, you've got to have your home place.
The workplace.
And then your third place. It doesn't have to be a pub. Maybe it could be like, I don't know, playing golf. Or,
trying to think, what? Yours is maybe the gym.
It's weird because my hobby is now my job.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't really have much.
Your third place. It's like me. My third place is also my job, I think.
Yeah, I don't. I couldn't imagine them putting like a hobby or something else. I just don't really have the time for it. I don't know. I wouldn't want to go and start playing darts, for example, or going, I don't know.
Got your job blend into friendships as well and kind of life as well.
Yeah, especially since I started a company with my wife, which was another daunting, kind of faintly stressful making, but in the end, really beneficial, I think, was that my wife and I, 5-6 years ago, started a company together. So I left the BBC. Previously, I'd made programs through the BBC, like as a BBC contractor. And then we started a company called Mindhouse. And then now we've got a little, like a kind of business family, like a second family, which is everyone who's either employed or on contract at Mindhouse. So that's been really good. But, I've got, now that the kids are getting a bit older, there's tiny little holes appearing in the diary. Do you know what I mean? Like suddenly, it's not as full on. It's not as all hands to the pump. Well, if you do that, who's going to take the kids to the park? Who's going to do the? Now it's like, oh no, they can actually manage. As I say, the little one's 11, so there's still a bit of that. But I'm starting to think like I might need a hobby. Might need to get down to the gym or something.
There we go.
MMA
champion combat.
What's do they have MMA like seniors?
I would probably recommend doing more like jiu-jitsu, like Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Is there no MMA over for the over 50s?
Not really. Like it's gonna wear a fair bit on your body, to be honest.
My brother does BJJ.
Yeah, that jiu-jitsu BJJ, yeah. same thing. Yeah, and I mean,
he says the recovery time. He's older than me, so he's like the recovery time is getting rough. He did 2 bouts, I think. Like he, you know, obviously not. You know, it was with other people of similar age.
Yeah,
yeah. He's a writer. He's not like a fighter, but he won his first bout, and then the second one he lost. I shouldn't be saying, maybe he doesn't want to put that out there, but he says it's quite rough on the old body.
I mean, it's the least, there's not a lot of impact in jiu-jitsu. You're basically on the ground with someone, yeah, rolling.
Grappling.
Yeah, exactly, grappling. But
how old are you, Tom?
33, almost.
What's your plan?
For the rest of my fighting career?
Yeah.
I've always been under the idea that I want to be done sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's getting to the point where I'm closer to the end than I am the beginning. I'm at the point now where the generation who I aspire to be like are retired now. And
who would be the standout?
Just guys like Michael Bisping, Chuck Liddell, mm-hmm. Randy Couture, Anderson Silva, people like this. Are you familiar with those names?
Yeah.
Those are the kind of guys who are like the generation before me. And now I'm at the point where I can, I wouldn't say I can call them friends, but I'm friendly with them. I've been around them in social situations, and I can see the wear and tear that it takes out of people's bodies.
Correct me if I'm wrong, not as punishing on the head as boxing.
I don't think so, but I'm also obviously going to side towards MMA. I think that boxing, especially the smaller guys for some reason, if you're a smaller guy, you naturally carry less power than bigger guys, mm-hmm. which means that you're going to take more punches to the head mm-hmm. over the 36 minutes that you're fighting for 12 yeah. rounds. Now in boxing...
As opposed to like one clean knockout.
Exactly. Yeah. So the guys in boxing... They'll get dropped. They'll usually get up on 6 or 8 or whatever the 10 count is, and then they're immediately allowed to go again.
Yeah.
And then that can happen 3 times in a round for 12 rounds, which is, in my opinion, that's a lot of almost being completely concussed repeatedly.
Yeah. And it's the repetitive concussions that does the damage.
Whereas with MMA, it's like, it sounds more brutal, and it definitely is, looks more brutal, but you get hit. They follow you down, they hit you once more, and that's it.
I said this to Ian Wright. I mean, I take the same view, and he was really shocked by that. There seems to be an image in some areas, like an image problem for MMA. People are like, oh, that's, they've still got that 90s vision of it as
cockfighting,
kind of like human cockfighting. Yeah. That was John McCain's phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, as you say, like, I think there's a real case for saying it's in the long term less punishing. Do you enjoy fighting?
I mean, that could be the most complicated question that you could ask me.
Best question.
It was a great question. I mean, yeah, maybe you should do documentaries or something.
I'm interviewing you now.
Yeah, that's perfectly allowed.
Safe space.
Yes, I do enjoy fighting because you've got to remember for a long time, so I started training when I was around 8, 9 years old. I started competing in MMA when I was 16 because that was the earliest that I was allowed to compete in MMA. Before then, I competed in the individual discipline. So I had some boxing fights, some wrestling fights, grappling and all that stuff. By the time I got to 16, I was of legal age where I can get in a cage and fight somebody in front of people, which was my dream at the time. From being 16 to... Because MMA fighters on the local circuit, they don't make any money. We're getting £500 for a fight, which is not enough. From 16 to 26, 27, the maximum I ever got paid was £600-700 for a fight. So for all that time, I didn't make any money at all. And the prospect of making money was actually quite slim. So that must mean I did enjoy it. And I still do enjoy it. I still absolutely love MMA. That doesn't mean it doesn't scare me to death, because it absolutely does.
Does it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Quite reassuring to hear that.
Yeah.
Some people say, oh no, I just get in there, I can't wait to get in.
Some guys are like that. I've met some
some fighters, again, like I just said, I'm in the point where I socialise with a lot of fighters as well. A lot of fighters are my friends. I know some guys, they're not even bothered about winning or losing. They just want to have a fight.
Yeah.
And I would have been good. If I would have put the same dedication to MMA as I would have done football, for example, I would have been a professional footballer. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a professional athlete and my chosen sport is MMA.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Can I ask you first, and then obviously, Louis, please answer, what are you both most proud of in your career today?
The thing that I'm most proud of is being able to look after my family with something that I like doing, I think. I mean, I think a lot of people would have thought, oh, you won the world title here, you fought in this place or that place, because I've had some amazing experiences in my career. I've done a lot of cool stuff, but the coolest thing that I've ever done is buying a house that's nice for my family to be able to live in, I think.
I think for me, it's the idea of being able to use creativity. Like the idea, the endorsement that gives me as you know, that I could make a living out of something that is, you know, it just involves some small bit of creative energy. In addition, I would say also the fact that over the years that I've done it, sustaining the career and growing, starting out as a prankster, provocateur, and then taking on more serious subjects and staying on the horse long enough and having enough faith in myself to push it into areas I'd never have thought I could when I started, like stories about mental health, Alzheimer's, stories about serious disorders or people drinking too much, where it's not like, oh, I'm going to go in and ask cheeky questions. Mm-hmm. It's something a bit more finely layered.
Is there one area, though, if you could really pinpoint it, that you're extremely proud of?
Well, the program, my son asked me the other day, unusually, because they don't, you know, it's not like they're always talking to me about my career and stuff. He said, like, what do you think? I think it was because Manosphere was on. He's like, what do you think is your best documentary? And I just, well, I don't really like to say, but probably one I did called The Most Hated Family in America.
Yeah, that was a three parts.
There were three parts. Yeah. Actually, originally it was just a one-off, and then we went back for seconds and thirds. But the first one in particular, for various reasons, I do think it's I'm particularly proud of that one. And I think that one, and you know, someone who didn't know who I was, no history with me, could watch that and be like, oh yeah, that's really good. I could sort of hold that and go like, yeah, that's really good.
How did you feel like the second time you went, like the first time you were pretty unknown kind of British reporter going in there?
It was the Westboro Baptist Church. It was a kind of cult-like religious group in Kansas, led by a guy called Pastor Fred Phelps. There's about 100 of them, and they believed that it was their duty to picket funerals, concerts, mainly the funerals of soldiers, with homophobic placards that used offensive terms, saying "Thank God for dead soldiers." And then the idea was that the deaths of soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan were God's punishment for an America that was overly tolerant of homosexuality.
Yeah, that was the background. That's exactly what. Yeah, and the pickets where they turn up with your kid. The kids are carrying, have you seen it? Carrying signs that says like God hates fags on it and everything. It's
yeah,
crazy.
Little stick men, a kid's holding a placard of like two stick men having kind of sex together. And then I'm talking to the kids like, what's up? Why are you holding that? And they don't really know why. But you know, and I encourage people to watch it, obviously. But it's truthfully, for the paradox there was that behind the scenes, they were very welcoming. They let me in because part of their prophecy was that everyone in the world needed to hear their message in order for Jesus to come back. So they saw me as what they called a door of utterance, like a part of the holy plan, God's plan to get their message out in the world. So they were like, oh, we know you hate us and, you know, and God hates you because you're hellbound sinners, but while you're here, would you like a cup of, would you like some lemonade or come in, you know, and yeah, please sit down. And they were very civil and highly educated.
But the second time you went back, this is what I was going to ask, is the first time you were like this unassuming British guy who, you know, you were there to kind of promote their thing and stuff. The second time you went back, they just decided that you're on the other side.
They knew the first time, that I was media and therefore not friendly, but they didn't really know what my vibe was. The second time they knew what my vibe was. And so they kind of are on the front foot going like, one of them goes, he says, he calls me a jack weasel. I remember that. He's called Steve Drain. And then he goes, you know, you're a mocker and a scoffer. And, you know, we're preaching the word of God. He says, we're the only people on earth now presenting the gospel as it's supposed to be taught. You're making fun of us. You're one of the most chief, and then he goes, you're one of the most chief workers of iniquity in the entire history of man. You're right up there with Pontius Pilate.
I've seen it. But the, like, how do you...
Which is a big compliment, by the way.
Yeah.
Imagine that level
your
of cosmic...
Your memory's unbelievable.
Well, yeah. I mean, or maybe my level of narcissism, but I've seen it many times. But the idea of like, oh, wow, I'm one of the most evil people who ever lived.
But when you're thinking... So you're aware now that they've got that... They feel that way about you. When you're waking up the next day and you know that you've got to go back and film again,
yeah.
Like what's going through your mind when you're thinking, fucking hell, these guys, I'm just the devil to those guys and I've got to spend all day.
But they were so friendly. And so that's the thing, like that there's definitely times when it's super stressful, but that is not one of them. At least you're all on the same page. Like, you know, I know that they don't hate me. They just think God hates me and that I'm a jack weasel. It's all slightly theoretical. It's much more difficult where if you're with someone who you think probably might think that this is going to be a more positive piece than it is, or is sensitive about criticism and you're having to tiptoe a little bit around the things that you have an issue with. Like, for example, I did a whole program. In fact, I made two programs about Joe Exotic. And when I arrived at his park on that first or second day, maybe the first day, this was 2011, way before Tiger King was the phenomenon that it was. And I was like, oh, I asked a couple of questions like, you know, there's always like one question that is kind of the nub of the whole thing. But with you, it's kind of like, do you like to fight, right? That would be, in a sense, if I made a documentary about you, it'd be like, does he like to fight? He does, but with these kind of qualifications. And with Joe, it was always like, well, do the animals like being in the cage? You know, brackets, and if they don't, why are you keeping them in a cage, right? There's this sort of moral question at the heart of it. But I remember asking myself, the animals, do you think the tigers, you know, they're used to roaming thousands of miles or at least hundreds of miles in India. Do you think they like being in a cage about the same as this podcast studio size? And I could see that it really bothered him being asked about it. And then you get a sinking feeling. And then you go back to the hotel and think, oh, wow, this is going to be an awkward shoot.
What was he like to be around Joe Exotic? Because I've recently rewatched Tiger King. I watched it obviously in COVID when it first came out, recently rewatched it.
But the whole thing, like, it's 10 hours.
Yeah, I watched season two, but then season two started to get a bit too conspiracy theory-ish.
Oh, I've never watched season two.
It's not great, to be honest. It becomes like Jeff Lowe, the fella who overtook the zoo versus...
Who backstabbed Joe Exotic.
Kind of Carol Baskin and then all these... It was a bit more of a... You know, sometimes Netflix go too far on the conspiracy stuff for me sometimes.
Do they?
Yeah, for me. And then I rewatched your thing with him.
Which one? The first one or the second one?
The first one.
Okay.
And he seemed to just like... It was almost all about him and he wanted to be famous. Was that the way that you came across like a person?
Very much so. His whole thing was wanting to be famous, wanting to be a star. He had a Hollywood, his dream was, he'd even say, next stop Hollywood. Like, he goes like, what was his thing? Like, BBC's coming here and they're going to make me into a star. And when I arrived, you could see like in those early bits of footage, you can see how excited he is. He's practically twitching kind of with nervous energy. Like, we were the first crew that went there. He even said that you're the first people to come here. Might be the last too. I can't remember why you thought we were the last. But and so you see in those early days, there's this tremendous fragility and a need for approval, which I think explains a lot about also the outfit that he was running, which was he had a kind of huge coterie of yes people, people who were vulnerable in different ways, on the edge of homelessness, very poor area of Oklahoma that his park was in, people who'd slipped through the cracks. Oklahoma in general, there's not a lot of welfare, social support for people who are indigent. And they'd arrive and he'd rehome their the animals, and then he'd rehome the humans. And then he'd be sitting atop it, just sort of craving this unqualified love and approval. I did one. I did one where it was like Ike Turner was another one. Do you know who Ike Turner is? So obviously he's famous. He's dead now, but he was married to Tina Turner, and he was immortalized in a film called "What's Love Got to Do with It." The fact that Tina said, and I in fact believe that he was brutal towards her. He was like, about, you know, domestic violence. But when I was with him, I thought, oh, this would be a good documentary. We can sort of paint a picture of this complicated man who's, you know, got a hair trigger temper and who's now depicted as one of the most awful people in the public mind because he's been, you know, played by Lawrence Fishburne in the movie. And then day one, I asked one question about Tina and then he went off a bit later. And then my sound recorder said, oh, he was still on mic. He'd gone off and he called his agent. He said, if that asshole asks one more question like that, I'm out of here. I was like, all I asked was like, how, what was it like being married to Tina or something like that?
About being uncomfortable. Sorry, Louis. That's right. I've heard you say it on podcasts about, you know, you're doing your job when you feel uncomfortable as well. Because you're sort of saying about when you go back and you think, this is going to be a sinking feeling. Is that?
That's a different kind of uncomfortable. Well, kind of. Like it's not a sinking feeling. The feeling of discomfort that's positive is the feeling of nervousness that you're going to touch the electric fence in some way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Some feeling of like, oh, this is going to be, am I going to get it right? This feels charged. Are we running the risk of, you know, platforming someone or some people going to be like, that person shouldn't be on TV? That's generally quite a good thing because I'm not supposed to be interviewing people I agree with.
Are you getting nervous though in that point, or is that just because obviously in my head of a content creation, I'm thinking this is great on one side, but I think that's your USP almost, is that you do really care about that person. You don't want to step too far as well.
Well, that's a good point. Like, the other part of it is, as you say, that I do worry about contributors, and I worry about the kind of the moral dimension of feeling okay about myself. Like, I could never be a kind of classical prankster. Like, somebody's like goes in with a mask or records people secretly on purpose, where at the end I'm like, surprise. This isn't the program you thought it was. I genuinely, probably to a fault, am kind of agreeable, inclined to try to not overly upset or confront. Like, it takes more. People say, like, how do you stay so calm? It takes more work to not be calm, you know, to be like, how dare you do this thing? Like, I have to sort of work myself up to that because it's an adversarial attitude that doesn't come that naturally to me.
Where does that come from, though? Where does that sort of, because a lot of people are reactive in today's world, and even everything that you sort of show in Manosphere is that they want to go to that extreme, whereas you're the complete opposite. Where does that come from?
We might need to get a therapist in here. I don't know, but it comes very naturally. I mean, you could say, well, I know my job is to be a journalist. Like, it's not to sort of be a prosecutor, an interrogator, or a therapist, but that only gets you so far. I think there's a part of me that perhaps just is just so curious. I'm more curious than I am, in a sense, judgmental. But I think there's a part, if I was going to big myself up, I'd say, there's a part of me thinks like, maybe this person's got the answers. Like, I'm not that, maybe I'm not so sure of myself that I sort of automatically think the person's completely wrong. Does that mean I go in there thinking like, well, let's just find out what's going on here. And if there's something behind the scene, there's something in the logic to how they've come to their beliefs that needs to be pried out.
You're a storyteller.
I'd like to be. Appreciate that.
Final question, because you've been amazing with your time, which we ask every guest on the Inner Game, is when the pressure's on the line, every feeling under pressure, what is going on inside your head? What's the inner game of Louis Theroux?
Well, to make it really prosaic, my mum said early on, I remember when I was freaking out because I had to do a project on the Tudors at school. It was just kind of getting very, I was just spiraling. And she said, just go to bed and look at it again tomorrow morning. Like, you know, like it's so basic, but small tricks like that, that your mind plays on you when you're tired or you're run down, you just take a pause, just check out, just say, put it to one side and approach it with a different mental attitude the next day. The other parts are just, I mean, that's the most, I mean, it sounds like, what, really, Louis, did you just say something that primitive and basic? But I found that helpful. I also find that the more you achieve, it's not that you stop worrying and get like enormous reserves of confidence, but you have a track record that you can remind yourself of. So small wins that that you reflect on, you know, you almost, that emotional disabling reaction can be challenged and dialed down just by your mental faculties looking at things rationally.
Basic and logic, exactly like
so basic.
No, he's exactly the same. Him and his dad being around them every day.
Yeah,
there's a lot to be said for it, isn't there?
I think so. It's like you were saying, the more times you've done, basically saying, the more times you've done it, the easier it gets.
Yeah,
a lot of the time, I think.
Loved it. Do you wanna wrap
and
it up?
Do stuff you enjoy. Like the other thing is, like, don't get in. Sometimes you're like, why am I doing it? Just remind yourself, why do I like this thing?
That's what I do all the time.
And if you can't remember why you like it, then maybe you don't like it. You know what I mean? But usually, I've done so much in my life just based on the things that I think I'm supposed to be good at. I'm like, maybe I'm not that. I was never able to do pieces to camera. Like, I just found, like, weird talking to a camera. I get very stiff. I was never that good at learning lines, acting, being on stage where I had to work with a script. None of those things ever came naturally. I've never been good at them. And I thought, well, that's disqualifying me from broadcasting. But it turns out, like, the opposite, which is winging it, being in the moment, being awkward, leaning into those aspects of you that's unpolished, that's sort of kind of gritty and kind of a bit bumbling and real, that's been the whole basis of my career. All the things that I thought were why I couldn't be doing the job I do have proved to be my biggest assets.
Louis, thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, it's
thank you, man. It's an honor. It's an honor to be here, Tom.
Thank you.
For real. I hope I could be your next fight. Whenever it may be.
We could literally have Tom doing your top 10 Louis Theroux. Maybe we'll do that as a little
do that as a bonus.
Yeah, as a separate piece
for
documentaries. But that has been Louis on Tom Aspinall's The Inner Game. Please go and check out Louis' channels, all the good stuff. Obviously Manosphere as well, of course. And yeah, we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Next time on The Inner Game, Grace Neutral.
Being a teenager, that's when the trouble really started. I start coming home with tattooed eyes and bits of my face cut off, pushing my physical boundaries. You know, I love the way a tongue split looks, but can I do it? Can I actually handle sitting down and have someone cut my tongue in half?
Getting beat up alone is pretty shit. But then if you're going to do it in front of literally millions of people, I just can't think of much worse than that.
Tattooing was something that always gave me a purpose. I wanted to be the best. I can prove my place here. My friend said to me years ago, shut up, you're Grace fucking Neutral.